The following program is brought to you by Sports Leisure Vacations, and the views and opinions may not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of this station.
Today on The Travel Guys.
Princess is adding a new high-speed, reliable, that's their word, not mine, Wi-Fi to more of their ships to meet surging traveler demand. U.S. airfares hit their lowest level in 25 years, and New Jersey is creating the Anthony Bourdain Food Trail. Updates next in The Travel News.
In our Smarter Traveler segment at 3:20, Mark has a rant on hotel rooms with weird features, a way to solve airline bookings, and a comment on traveling when you are sick and might infect others, and I think this is a direct attack on me.
We should probably tell folks that as you sound like you are near death, you are at home and not in the studio. And no, it wasn't. But thank you for not coming here and getting us all whatever it is, the creeping crud that you have. We are big on trails here on The Travel Guys. And at 3:35, we take you on the Coca-Cola Trail, which includes a stop in Placerville.
Travel writers Chris Barnett found himself with a bad hip and unable to drive. So for the last 2 months, he's had to depend on Uber and Lyft. And at 3:50, Chris tells us about life and times as an Uber lifter.
It's a little after 3 o'clock on Sunday afternoon, and we are most pleased you have chosen to join us on the latest edition of The Travel Guys.
On the road again. Just can't wait to get on the road again.
I've got two tickets to paradise.
North to Alaska. I go north to Russia's own.
Lord, I was born a rambling man.
I come from a land of love.
I bless the rains down in Africa.
Get your kicks.
With the show.
Welcome to the latest edition of The Travel Guys. I'm Mark Hoffman, and somewhere near a dumpster or in a graveyard somewhere is my broadcast partner, Tom Romano.
This is, you know, this is all for your benefit. You know, part of my job is to make you sound better. And I think this is clearly helping. There's no doubt about it. I know. I always hate it when I tune into the evening news and there's an anchor person who chose to not stay home, and then you got to put up a 30-minute newscast with them sounding like death warmed over. So I will keep my portion of The Travel Guys to a minimum.
You ran off to Southern California is the reason that you, if you were not running around Disneyland and being infected by all of the other people there, you were going to give us a wonderful report about how you had resolved some of the standing in line problem at Disneyland.
And you know, we'll save the long version of that for later on. But yeah, I managed to come down with this cold, sinus, lost my voice. I can't hear out of my right ear. all probably contracted before I even got on the plane. Number one advice, I guess, and I don't know how to solve this, but you know, you're on a holiday, you have a cold or something that's caused you to get ear congestion. You know, what do you do if you fly with it? You'll end up with, like me, in that the pressure, you know, in the cabin and all of that will force your ear to close. So I guess I should have rented a car and drove home.
or you could have just, you know, sat on the beach and waited for the tide to come in. I mean, that would have been the other possibility.
At
Sports Leisure Vacations, we have a dumpster located outside about, 100 yards or so from our front door. And the company policy is that if you feel the end might be near, is you go out and position yourself close to the dumpster, because after all, as a courtesy to the other people that you work with, because dead weight is so hard to move. And so it's so much easier if you're already out there. So you don't live too far from the Sports Leisure office. So maybe the wife could drive you over there and just leave you outside by the dumpster. And that way, if anything were to happen, why, you'd at least be in a place that where you'd be close to home, so to speak.
you're in exceptionally creative form today. And I'll park that idea.
Yeah, that's it. All right. Well, if you can hang with us here for a few minutes, why, we'd love to hear some of your last comments, but this is the time of the show. It's time for us to do the travel news. Our friend Huey Lewis and the news. The Anthony Bourdain Food Trail is coming to New Jersey. This will probably, Tom, this will probably pop up in more than one place, I'm guessing. But I'm surprised that the folks in Jersey beat the folks in New York to it. Bourdain did a 2015 episode for his CNN show, Parts Unknown. And he made about 10 stops on the show in the greater New Jersey area. And so they've gone to all of these places. And indeed, this is New Jersey Tourism is working on putting together the Anthony Bourdain Food Trail. Would you spend a day doing something like that, just going around and visiting the places that he visited?
You know, he was so fabulous, and everything he discovered was I don't think there was ever a clunker. Absolutely.
Yeah, no, that sounds like it would. I'm not much for going to faraway places and eating things that are still moving. But which he liked to do, but things in New Jersey, well, some of those are probably still moving too. But nonetheless, I think that would be worthwhile. Sure. And my guess is that we'll see some more. You might see that on a sports leisure tour sometime soon. China is closing Tibet to foreign visitors for a couple of months. There are a couple of political anniversaries in March, 60th anniversary of a couple of things that occurred in China. I won't go into great detail here, but the country is, Tibet is going to be closed almost entirely to foreign journalists and diplomats. Along to visitors, there are also, as reported, heavy security on the ground. All of this, it was the 59 uprising in Tibet that triggered the flight of Tibet's famed traditional Buddhist leader, the Dalai Lama, who now lives in exile in India. So if you're planning a visit to China sometime in the next few months, and you're planning on going to Tibet, that's something you want to check up on. Princess Cruises has a really PR-related press release here, Tom. I put this in the travel news, and I was going over it last night, and I realized I'd kind of been had. And it says, officials from Princess Cruises announced Friday, the company's Medallion Net Wi-Fi service would be available to passengers sailing on over half of the ships in the cruise line's fleet by the end of the year. In other words, somebody at Princess was having a slow news day, so they decided that by the end of the year, they would have more than half their ships on this new high-speed Wi-Fi, since they charge you a ridiculous amount for it anyway, and it barely works, and that it would be half of their ships, not all of their ships, mind you, but half of their ships, and it wouldn't occur till the end of the year. So none of this is actually happening now, but like I said, it must have been a slow news week maybe for Princess.
My question is it going to be in the front half or the back half of the half of the ships?
Of the ships. Yeah. American Airlines might be in a little bit of trouble with their flight attendants. It seems as though the flight attendants union is charging the airline with discriminating against their flight attendants. They have created new attendance policies for flight attendants, which apparently are much more rigid than those for pilots. It so happens, of course, that about 75% of the flight attendants are female, while about 85% of the pilots are male. So the flight attendants union, taking note of this, has said, well, there seems to be different rules for the men than there are for the women. More on that soon. Airline cameras, speaking of airlines, ignite fears of privacy invasion in travel industry. It appears as though Singapore Airlines and American Airlines, both the TV screens that are on the backs of the seats of the aircraft that they fly, there are little cameras attached to those. So hypothetically, they could be watching you while you're watching them. Singapore and American have both said that the cameras are not attached, and they have no plans to attach them anytime soon. And that's all fine and wonderful. And my answer to that would be, how would we know if they weren't attached? Or
now that you mentioned that, the flight attendant on my Southwest flight, they were going through the instructions, pointed out that it was against the law, and you will be removed from the plane, so forth, if you damage the smoke detector or the camera in the restrooms.
In the restrooms, yes. Well, that's I can only imagine. Occasionally, though, Tom, I've been on airplanes where someone comes out of the bathroom, and this cloud of smoke follows them out of the bathroom, and it's like, really, dude, it's almost always a guy. Really, you thought you were going to go into that little tiny space with all of these people within a couple of feet surrounding you, and you were going to take a few puffs and you were going to come out, and no one was going to notice that you had done that. And, you know, doing something like that in an airplane, that could be like the most expensive cigarette or vaping device that you'd ever inhaled off of in your entire life, things that could follow when you get to the ground. U.S. airfares, it is reported, Thomas, yes. From the Bureau of Transportation Statistics say that U.S. airfares have hit a new low. This comes with a small asterisk. Airfares, average fare for airline travel has hit its lowest level in nearly 20 years. The average domestic itinerary was $343 in the last half of last year, which is a drop of about $2 from the third quarter of the previous of 2017, and a $7 decrease from the second quarter of 2016. However, it's important to note that those prices are taken off of the airline's lowest reported fare for sale, which means that they are incorporating those basic economy fares, which means that the reality is that in most cases, those fares that they're reporting as being slightly lower are actually $20 or $30 higher, because to compare them with the same ticket, am I driving people crazy here? Does this make any sense? If you compare this to the same ticket that you bought before basic economy fares came out, when you could store something above and you could get a seat assignment and all that, and you compare the fare now, then yes, they're basically the same fare, but you're not getting the same amount of services for that same fare. So it's a little misleading to say that airfares are lower than they've ever been, because if you were willing to go naked, sit in a middle seat, and not bring anything with you, then airfares are the same. For some of you, we would prefer that you bring something with you and not go naked. Last week, Tom, the jet stream got so high on the East Coast that a flight was flying 800 miles an hour. Now, to give you an idea, the average plane flies about 500 miles an hour. A Dreamliner can fly 560 miles an hour. Many commuter planes are in the 300 to 400-mile range. So 800 miles an hour is fairly unbelievable. That means that if you were in the jet stream the whole way across the country, a five-hour flight would take you about 3 hours and 15 minutes. Most planes only got into it for a short period of time. It was over 800 miles an hour over Western Pennsylvania on Monday evening. Can you imagine that?
That's cool. There you go.
You could take off. If you changed time zones, you could land before you took off.
You could charge extra for that.
That's what I'm thinking. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is your travel news for today. When we come back after the break, we're going to talk a little bit about booking travel for cruises. I have a reminder for you there. I have a suggestion about how airlines might be able to resolve some of the overbooking, and a rant about hotel rooms. Have you been in one of those hotel rooms recently where they have smoked windows in the bathroom? Anyways, we'll talk about it after the break. We are the Travel Guys, right back in 3 minutes. Welcome back to the Travel Guys, brought to you by Sports Leisure Vacations. You can find links to some of the cool things we talk about here on the Travel Guys at travelguysradio.com. I'm Mark Hoffman. I'm in the studio. Tom Romano is at home near death being nursed by his lovely wife, Stephanie.
I'm nowhere near death. My gosh. What are you're already planning my replacement, I can tell.
Well, if you call in, I think if you call and ask for arrangements on the weekend, there's some kind of a discount or something. So
I see. Well, I want to thank Steve. He did a great job for me last week. And, you know, and this does give me an opportunity to go downstairs and, you know, get some whiskey or something for my throat in the middle of the show, which I can't do if I'm in the studio. So I'm feeling better already.
If you come back and you sound three sheets to the wind, we'll know that you are three sheets to the wind. Let's talk a little bit about hotel rooms here. I have, well, first, before we do that, I have an article here, Tom, from Travelers United. It's a group that I joined. You can go online and join them. Perhaps I will get someone. They bugged me for a long time, and I'm glad that I joined them because once a week, believe it or not, is all, they send you an email, and usually there is something in there that would be of value to someone who travels a lot. For example, this week they were reminding folks that travel insurance is really important, especially when you're taking a long trip or a cruise. But one of the things that you really can do for yourself, especially if you're taking a cruise or a tour that departs on a set time, you're not just on an independent itinerary where missing a day is not a problem for you. But as we've talked about before in this program, is give yourself a little bit extra time at the beginning of your vacation. Allow, instead of flying in the day that the cruise or the tour departs, even across, if you're just going across the country, but especially if you're going over an ocean, fly in the day before. Heck, if I were going over an ocean and I had paid thousands of dollars for a cruise or an itinerary for a tour, and it was someplace I'd wanted to go all of my life, and knowing what I know about travel and how things can change and weird things that can happen, you know, the door on the jetway gets stuck and your plane gets delayed and you miss your connection. I mean, strange things like that. I would go a day, or maybe even if it were overseas, 2 days early, because then you take all that stress out. And if something happens and your plane is 3 or 4 or 5 hours late, you don't really care. And so I thought that Travelers United, they were good to point that out. They also talked about another thing that was, this is especially appropriate, Tom, since you're kind of under the weather today and out of the studio. They're talking about airlines not allowing people to cancel tickets even when they are ill, and even when, you know, they can prove that they're ill. On a rare occasion, an airline will refund a ticket if you can produce a death certificate and show that the person who had the ticket is physically not going to show up to fly because they are dead. Sometimes you can get an airline to refund a ticket, not all the time, but sometimes. But when somebody is really ill and they've got an airline ticket, and they know one of two things is going to happen. They know that, for example, they're on the outbound. So if they don't fly, their return ticket is going to get canceled. So they can't wait a day. And if they make a change, they're going to pay not only a $200, $150 or $200 fee, unless you're flying on Southwest Airlines, you're also going to, if you called United and you said, hey, I can't fly tomorrow morning, Monday, but could I maybe fly Tuesday? I think I'll be well enough to fly by then. They'd say, well, Mr. Romano, we'd be happy to do that. There'll be a $200 charge for you changing the ticket. And then, oh, by the way, the fare now for Tuesday's flight is $675. So, and you only had a ticket that was for $300. So you'll have to pay us an extra $375. And then, of course, there's that nasty little $200 fee that we mentioned. So for only about $575, we'd be happy to give you a middle seat, because that's all that's left, on the seat on the flight on Tuesday instead of letting you fly on Monday. So then what you do is you say, well, screw that. I'm not going to let the airlines take me to the cleaners. I'll just go and fly anyway. And then you've effectively infected half a plane load of people, because that doesn't.
Yet.
Yeah, well, you know, and then there's the other side of this story. I'm a tour operator. So I have people who make commitments to go on trips with my company. And then sometimes some of them have something unforeseen happen and they're unable to go. Sometimes it's a personal thing. Sometimes it's an illness, you know, life, one of those life happens things. So some people take some insurance to be some protection, to be able to protect themselves in those situations. But some people sometimes get into those situations, and this is why the airlines aren't a little bit more liberal in these rules. If the airlines allowed you to produce a note from the doctor and get out of the change fee and the ticket waiver, notes from doctors would start appearing all over the place. How do I know this? Because for 40 years, I've been a part of that sort of process. So many doctors are very ethical people, and they won't write a note for somebody that says, Susie is sick, please excuse her from the trip because she's not able to go. But some doctors will. So that's the challenge, is that if it was a perfectly clean system, then people could bring a note from the doctor and the airline could say, all right, this is legit. But how do they know that you just didn't have something come up and you suddenly can't travel? And so you went to your doctor, who's a buddy of yours, and said, hey, write me a note. And the doctor did.
There you go.
So that's why airlines don't allow you to get out of a ticket very easily. Now, it seems to me like they could maybe make a compromise there. They could charge you a fee for changing and give you the same fare as you had when you bought the original ticket, so that there would be a penalty, but the penalty wouldn't be too awful. I promised we were going to talk about hotels here for a little bit. And there is this incredible tendency, Tom, of hotels nowadays, especially in the bathroom, to create these really unbelievable situations like smoked windows. Have you run into these yet?
I have not. What hotels have you run across?
Well,
this?
An Embassy Suites had it. A Marriott had it. A Spring Hill Suites had one. The big wall of the bathroom is a smoked window, so you can kind of see if somebody's moving around behind it, but you can't see exactly what they might be doing. Now, I don't know about you, but if you have a roommate in your room and it's not your spouse, or even if it is, you may or may not want the person on the other side of the wall to be figuring out exactly what it is while you're doing your business on the other side of the wall.
So it's a window that looks into your hotel and not out.
Well, it's a window in your hotel. It's a piece of glass inside the room that is kind of smoked. Or you've got these walls now on the hotel doors that are kind of like barn doors, and they the whole door will swing. It's not a swing, but it will come all the way shut, but it leaves a space between the door and the wall, and the door doesn't actually lock. It just sort of closes.
Got it. I've seen those.
So if you're modest on any level, why, if you're traveling by yourself, this isn't a problem. In Spring Hill Suites, one of the properties in Milwaukee I site inspected not too long ago, the TV was mounted in such a way that if you took the second bed by the window, you couldn't see the television set. Some hotels now have doors where you open the door and you can't get all the way into the bathroom because the door won't open all the way. Are there rocket scientists that do these things, or I don't know.
Trying to come up with something different.
If you have something about a hotel room that drives you nuts, go to travelguysradio.com and leave us a little note. We'll talk about it next week. Thomas, I'm going to let you go, and we'll finish the second half. When we come back from the news, we're going on the Coca-Cola Trail right here on the Travel Guys.
Like to buy the world a home and furnish it with love. Grow apple trees and honeybees. The white turtle doves. I like to teach the world to sing. Sing with me.
Welcome back to the Travel Guys. Thank you, Luis, for finding that little ditty. Welcome to Larry. Larry, welcome to the Travel Guys.
Hey, thank you, Mark. It's a pleasure to be with you this Sunday afternoon.
Larry Jorgensen is the writer of the Coca-Cola Trail, and which is a really cool book about the places where Coca-Cola was first bottled. I happened to be, Larry, in Vicksburg just not too long ago in December, and had an opportunity to go to the museum there, and didn't know until I got there that indeed Vicksburg is where Coca-Cola bottling kind of started.
That's where the bottling first started. Of course, the formula for the syrup was developed in Atlanta, as everyone knows. But my book is not about Atlanta. It's about all the places where the syrup then was used for bottling, and the people that really made it happen throughout the United States to make Coca-Cola what it is today. All the independent bottlers that said, this is a great idea, we're going to make Coca-Cola.
And it started, for folks who are not up on their Coca-Cola history, the Vicksburg, it was first bottled in 1894 when carbonated water was put with a Coca-Cola syrup. And then spread all over the country. Larry, your book is a paperback book, but it's a couple hundred pages. There are, about 22 dozen chapters here, one of which is
actually 30 chapters.
Okay.
And I think, following along that line of how did it get started, the chapter about Chattanooga where we learned that the rights to bottle Coca-Cola throughout the United States were sold by Coca-Cola for $1. That was how it all got started. And then the two gentlemen from Chattanooga that bought the rights to bottle Coca-Cola throughout the United States said, how are we going to do this? And they decided that the best way to do that would be to sell their rights a piece at a time. Franchise, you know?
Right.
And that's really how it all spread across the United States.
Now, chapter 10 in your book is about a place that some of the folks who are listening to our program might be familiar with, Placerville, California.
Absolutely.
And there's
a fabulous old Coca-Cola plant building. It's not a plant anymore. Last I heard when I wrote the book, it was a restaurant, kind of a, you know, a little cafe-type restaurant. But it has a great history of Coca-Cola bottling in that community. And it's certainly something worth, when it's so close to you, to go see. And you'll find a lot of other history in that same area. And a lot of it ties to Coca-Cola. It's a great area.
Well, and one of the figures that you wouldn't expect to be tied to Coca-Cola and Placerville, who had a lot to do with some of the early roads in this country, John Studebaker.
Absolutely.
Actually lived in Placerville. For some time, came to Placerville, according to your book, Larry, came to Placerville from Indiana in 1853 to seek his fortune in the gold fields. And there's a historical marker in Placerville at the site where Studebaker first worked.
Well, he sought his fortune, but he found out it was not in the gold field. He realized that where he could do the most was making wheelbarrows.
Mm-hmm.
So we have the first Studebaker is actually a wheelbarrow that John made while he was there. And he actually sold enough wheelbarrows to the gold miners that he was able to go back to Indiana. And then they started making they weren't making cars yet, but they were making Studebaker wagons and this type of thing.
Yeah.
And it evolved from there. But he got his start right in your backyard.
Now, what made you decide, Larry, and you call this the Coca-Cola Trail, and the way you've got it in your book, I'm guessing that folks could, you know, this is about more than just the Coca-Cola bottling plants. This is more about the communities where these historic spots are found. Would you not agree?
I agree. In fact, that you mentioned that, Mark, I had a gentleman from California sent me an email. And he said, I'm planning my summer vacation around the places in your book. So it is. It's a travel guide. It's a travel guide with the history of what you're looking at when you get there.
That sounds like a gentleman after my own heart. I've spent periods of time in my life traveling Route 66 a dozen or so times, the old Lincoln Highway, the National Road, the Yellowstone Trail. We take a tour of ballparks every year, which includes airplane travel, but nonetheless is sort of a trail to visit as many ballparks as we can. So I certainly, traveling a trail to find out about Coca-Cola sites, but there are really some, for example, who knew that there was a Nashville, Arkansas?
Right. Nashville, Arkansas with a little Coca-Cola museum right there at the bottler. The family has been bottling since, you know, the early 1900s, and they invite anyone who visits Nashville, Arkansas to visit their little Coca-Cola museum and learn the history of Coca-Cola bottling in Nashville, Arkansas.
Wow. And then there's Philadelphia, Mississippi.
Right. Philadelphia, again, an old Coca-Cola plant has now become the home for a museum for Mississippi country star Marty Stewart. And there's a lot of Marty there. There's also a lot of Coca-Cola. And there's also a very nice I guess you could call it a flea market, an antique store, whatever, in Philadelphia, that the lady has made contact with the people that last owned the Coca-Cola plant, and she has some very unique memorabilia in that store, and some of it's for sale.
You're listening to The Travel Guys. I'm Mark Hoffman. My broadcast partner, Tom Romano, is recuperating at home. We're talking with Larry Jorgensen. Larry has a book out called The Coca-Cola Trail, People and Places in the History of Coca-Cola. Larry, if you are a fan of old highways in this country, which I am, and you're traveling the old roads, one of the things that you will see are amazing signs. You know, there are a couple of old attractions along Route 66 where the Merrimack Caverns would go out and tell a farmer, look, I'll tell you what, we'll paint your barn for you if we can put a billboard on the side of the barn. And as you travel across the country, Coca-Cola, probably as much as any product, is known for having signs, many of them in unique places. You have a whole chapter in your book about Coca-Cola signs.
Actually have two. Have the one that tells the story of the oldest Coca-Cola mural in the country, which has been so designated by Coca-Cola. And it is indeed interesting as you travel. In fact, Asa Candler, who was the president of Coca-Cola at that time, once told Hollywood that, you know, it's going to be difficult for y'all to make a movie outside without getting a Coca-Cola sign in the background. You know, it was their goal, and they have been lovingly restored. There's many places, and if you travel that Route 66, there are several places you're going to find that have my book for sale as well.
Larry, before I let you go, tell me, is there a place in the book here that we haven't talked about? Is there a place that's really special that you would really suggest if folks are going to go out on the Coca-Cola Trail, they can only go one spot, where would it be?
I would think to get the best overall view, Monroe, Louisiana has got the Biedenharn Coca-Cola Museum. And it was, in fact, Joe Biedenharn that did that first modeling. And the convenient thing is, you were in Vicksburg. You were probably only about 60 or 70 miles from Monroe, Louisiana, so you can see them both. I'd encourage, take the time to see both of those museums. They're loaded with Coca-Cola history and memorabilia.
Larry, I really appreciate some of your time on a Sunday afternoon. The book is called The Coca-Cola Trail. You can go to travelguysradio.com and you will see a link there to the website that will tell you some more about the book. And also, you can purchase it there along with a couple of other cool products. So, Larry, thank you so much for your time today. Be well.
Well, thank you, Mark. It's been a pleasure talking to you. And I hope your people enjoy the book and our story.
You got it. The Coca-Cola Trail. We are the Travel Guys. When we come back, we're going to be talking to a travel writer who, by circumstance, found that for a couple months, all he could do was ride Uber and Lyft. And he has a story. He is back to tell us about it right after this on the Travel Guide.
I left my heart in San Francisco.
Welcome back to the last lap for the Travel Guys for a Sunday afternoon. I'm Mark Hoffman. We are brought to you by Sports Leisure Vacations. Tom Romano is at home recuperating. Tom, if you've been with us for the whole program, Tom joined us for the first half of the show with what was left of his voice. It was what a trooper. So I gave him a pass for the back half of the program. Before we go to our next guest here, there was one thing that fell by the wayside in our Smarter Traveler segment at 3:20. We were talking about a way for airlines to resolve some of the overbooking. And here's the deal. We were talking about illness and people not being able to get out of an airline ticket despite the fact that they might be legitimately sick, contagious, and could infect other people on the aircraft. But a separate issue is, let's pretend for a minute that you've got an airline ticket on Delta Airlines and it costs you $400 round trip. So you've flown half of it. And so the other half of it, let's pretend for a minute, is worth $200. There's a $200 fee to cancel the ticket. So now you know that you're not going to be able to travel for whatever reason. And you're thinking, well, should I call the airline and tell them that I'm not coming? Or what the heck? The $200 fee isn't really that fair. So why should I give them the courtesy of calling them and telling them that they have another seat that they can resell? They've already gotten their money out of me. The heck with them. So you don't show up and the airline knows this is going to happen a little bit. So they will tend to overbook. And that's why once in a while at the gate you hear, you know, an airline offering money to get people out of their seat in order to, because of the fact that too many people showed up. The computer miscalculated it a little bit. So my thought is, on these cheaper tickets, what if a ticket was below $200 or below $300? What if the change fee or the cancellation fee was only half of the value of the ticket? What if on a $200 ticket, you could still salvage a $100 refund or $100 on a future ticket? Would you not then be inclined to call the airline, which would let them have a more accurate count of the actual number of people who are going to show up, and would help them because now they know several days ahead of time, perhaps, that you're not coming, so they can resell that ticket to somebody for an inflated price or at least have that opportunity. And you've gotten a little something out of the ticket. And so I thought that was a pretty good idea of maybe on lesser price tickets. Of course, if you fly on Southwest Airlines, you don't have to worry about that because if you cancel, the value of your ticket is good for up to a year after the date that you have purchased the ticket. And always remember that when you're flying on U.S. Airlines, that you have a 24-hour window to cancel the ticket after you've bought it if you purchased it directly from the airline. And there'll be no charge from the airline. There'll be no charge from the airline if you bought the ticket from somebody else, but you may find that they have a charge for canceling within 24 hours that you can't get out of. So if you want that 24-hour window, as we always recommend here on the Travel Guys, better to book, to buy your tickets, your travel products from the person who is actually producing the product as opposed to a third party who might not be there to help you when the time comes. Okay, as we talked about a little bit earlier on the program, Chris Barnett is a travel writer. He writes for Joe Sent Me, a business traveler's blog site, if you will. And Chris and I have not talked before, but I saw last week that he had posted a really interesting column about how he had gotten rid of his car and had become an Uber lifter in the city of San Francisco. So Chris is joining us on the Travel Guys. Welcome, Chris, to the program.
Well, good afternoon. How are you?
Very good, sir. Loved your column about being an Uber lifter and had a medical situation myself in the fall. So for a couple of months, I was in the same kind of situation that you were, where I had to depend on these folks to show up. There was some upside and there was some downside. This is becoming the way of the world. And you mentioned in San Francisco, Chris, that because of your circumstances, you were using a car to go 6, 7, 8 blocks, which is not uncommon in the Uber and Lyft drivers tell me in big cities.
That's true. Because also, and then the worst part, when I was actually driving my own car, then I'd have to find parking and have to fight the meters, etc. Now that I'm an Uber rider, and I do use Uber more than Lyft, it is a dream. I walk out the door, and usually I get a car within 3 minutes, and sometimes in 2 minutes, and it takes me right to my office, and I'm out the door. I mean, and I'm out their door. So it's been a godsend for me.
Now, you mentioned that it's a hip replacement, that's a pending hip replacement that has put you in this situation, and you've ditched your car, right?
Yes, I did. I gave it to my house cleaning lady to sort of babysit it for a while.
Uh-huh. So do you think that when the hip replacement comes that you'll go back to the automobile or not?
I don't know. And, you know, when I start to add up the tickets, the couple of times I've been towed, the gas, I've got to do some number crunching on it. But the convenience, or sheer convenience, you can't beat this.
So what I was going to ask you, what are the upsides and the downsides of being totally dependent on Uber and Lyft? You said that, and also you said that you used Uber a little bit more than Lyft. Is that your preference? Or I tend to be more of a Lyft guy than Uber, but
yeah, I tend to use Uber more simply because I'm a little more familiar with it. I mean, I use it; it's just easier for me. However, when I use Lyft, I really don't have a real preference, but I just tend to, my finger just hits the Uber app, so. But I've had, like I say, very, very few problems. A couple of Ubers they've seen me limping along with my cane, and they've canceled me out and taken off. That sort of annoyed me.
Now, why would a driver do that?
Because I think he probably just didn't want to, he or she just didn't want to have to hassle with somebody who might, you know, may delay them getting in and out. I don't know why.
Uh-huh.
But it's happened to me a couple of times. But that's really the only real problem that I've had.
Now, Chris, are you a tipper when you ride with Uber and Lyft?
Absolutely. I tip. I always tip, and I'm pretty critical on giving, you know, the stars. If it's a good ride, I give 5 stars. If it isn't, I reduce it.
Uh-huh.
But then again, I also write about great bars and saloons, and I'm a saloon reviewer, so I'm the same way with a bartender.
Have you ever, you know how in the old days you'd ask a
yep.
taxi driver about, you'd say, hey, you know, I'm going down the street to 23rd and 9th there, you know, mm-hmm. a good place to eat down there or something like that. Have you gotten any travel tips per se, any helpful hints from Uber and Lyft drivers?
That's a very good question, because I sort of know my way around San Francisco, probably maybe better than the Uber drivers. I tend to schmooze with them. You know, what are you, what's your other job? Do you do this full time? And I've met, you know, all sorts of interesting people. Again, as a reporter, I'm more interested in about, you know, what's going on with them. So that's more of my questions.
Now, it's in some cities, like I was in Honolulu a couple of months ago, and I found that right. there were some times of the day when a taxi ride actually was, if not roughly the same price, even a little cheaper than an Uber slash Lyft ride. Have you found in San Francisco, because I mention this because traffic is heavy in the city from time to time, and
right.
and because they have surge pricing, have you run into some of that situation?
Absolutely. No, If I know that there's surge pricing, and you, the nice thing is you can check it, and they give you a price quote. Okay, and if it's too high, I'll go out and flag down a cab. And in many cases, the cab gives you, it's a better deal. You know, a couple of dollars less, plus it's right there. What I don't necessarily do is call a dispatcher and wait for a cab. Now, when I go to New York, for example, though, because there's so many cars there, I don't know any Uber driver tries to find me on a corner on, say, Park Avenue, I'll always jump in a cab there.
Chris, what do we say to people who might say, God, there's so many Uber and Lyft cars on the road now, particularly in places like New York and San Francisco? It's just creating a huge traffic problem.
Well, there's truth to that. Because I sat one time on a corner and I just saw it seemed like every third car was either a Lyft or an Uber car. So it is causing traffic, and that is a but that's just, to me, is sort of one of the urban ills. I'd rather wait a little bit in traffic than miss that car. The convenience to me is worth it.
Well, and in your case, when you're sitting in an Uber car, one could make the argument that that car is just replacing the car that you would have been driving.
That's absolutely what it is. Absolutely. I get in, I get out, and I don't have to worry about it because. In San Francisco, you have to worry. Well, as you know, you have to worry that the tickets. I've been towed a couple of times, and $720 to be towed.
Ouch!
So hey, it's not worth it. It's not worth it. Now, sometimes it's a little difficult if you have like 4 or 5 places to go in a day. You're going. You know, you're paying one way, so you can run up $50 worth of Uber cars to go to the cleaners, to go to the market, to go, you know, here to meet somebody. So yeah. So what I end up doing is I find myself getting more organized.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I was the same way when I found myself dependent on it. And now that you can add a stop or something like that, basically you can get a car. And if you could string it all together, as you said, though,
yep.
you don't have cars. Drivers can't wait for you while you're, although
right.
I have found that, you know, if it's 30 seconds or a minute or you're just running inside and grabbing the laundry and running right back out the door, that sometimes that's there's a little bit more negotiation level perhaps with an Uber than there is with a taxi driver.
Oh, that's a good point. I haven't tried that. I'm going to take your advice on that. Great tip.
Is there, Chris, is there anything that we've left out here that you've had all this experience with Uber and Lyft? Is there a tip or something that you would like to tell people, a to-do or maybe a not-to-do?
Well, like for example, they have different levels. They have Uber X, which is you get the car by yourself, or you have Uber Pool. And Uber Pool is like $3 or $4 less. Frankly, if I'm in a hurry, I don't want to necessarily pool. So you wait an extra 10 minutes or so like that, but, you know, to save $3 or $4. So you have to do the trade out on that. Then Uber has one other thing where I think they catch you in the middle of a block and it's the cheapest one yet. I just haven't tried that. the other thing is when you're standing on a car, you know, say at night, and there's like four or five Uber cars looking for different people, that can be a hassle.
Yeah, that's very true. Same thing at the airport. You know, there's 20 people standing there waiting for their car. And so it's a time when you've got to pay attention to license plate numbers and colors of cars and things of that sort. It is a different time, my friend. And it certainly, as you have found out, if you live in a city with 50 and 60 and 70 and $100 overnight parking rates and no parking to speak of to start with, all of this makes a lot of sense.
And remember, San Francisco has a lot of car break-ins. I write for the New Fillmore here, which is a newspaper, and we have a tremendous amount of car break-ins in Pacific Heights. So people just come in and break into your car and looking for things. So I don't have that risk either anymore.
So you're not paying for monthly parking. You're not worried about the car being broken into. Chris Barnett has been our guest. Chris writes for Joe Sent Me, which is a website for joesentme.com for business travelers. If you go to travelguysradio.com, there is a link to Chris's article on I Left My Car in San Francisco. Chris, I hope that we can give you a call again and get you back on the Travel Guys down the road. I really enjoyed your writing.
Happy to help. I'm here for you anytime. Take good care.
Thank you very much. Chris Barnett from Joe Sent Me. Pick up his column at travelguysradio.com. All right. We are just a few seconds here from the end of the program. My thanks again to Trooper Tom Romano, who joined us for the first half of the program from the funeral home. Tom, hopefully we'll be back in studio next week. Clayton Whitehead will be here. Clayton went to New Zealand on a long plane flight and a long cruise, and he's going to come back and tell us all about his trip, what worked and what didn't. You have a great week. Let dance like nobody's watching, and we'll see you next Sunday at 3 o'clock.